our great grandfathers, who were science fiction buffs, delighted in stories of alchemists, magicians, who would construct an automaton, and then by various alchemical or magical rites, transform this artificial being into a living thing, into a being that had power and the ability to act, to hear, to do. And in our Jewish tradition, the people who had this presumed capacity to turn an automaton into a living thing were not so much the alchemists or the wizards, but the Kabbalists. Presumably, they could take a bit of clay, shape it, sculpt it into human form, place upon its forehead the seal Emet, truth, a word which was powerful not only for what it signified, but because it was composed of the initial, the middle, and the concluding letters of the alphabet, thus including all the alphabet, all of the world. Recite the various Kabbalistic incantations appropriate to turning an artificial shaped sculpture into a living thing, a golem. And presumably, if they had done their work correctly and if they were pious, the thing came alive. Now, the golem, as this object was known in the medieval folklore, was not an object that was brought into being by the Kabbalists idly or simply as a whim. It was only when a community was threatened by some enemy, by a pogrom, by a crusade, that the Kabbalistic teachers resorted to this role in which they essentially played God, created life. And it was hoped that the golem, once it had been given power, would act as the guardian spirit of the community, defeating the enemy. This is the original bionic man. Now, when you play God, as mankind has long since learnt, the results are more often tragic than successful. And in most of these medieval tales about automaton and golems, ultimately the object created by men, by the wizards, by the alchemists, by the Kabbalists, in order to protect their communities, begins to run amok, to turn against its own creators. You have the story of the sorcerer's apprentice. If you visit Prague, if you go to the old new synagogue, old because it's old, new because they wish they had the money to repair it, and you slip a few kopecks to the shamus, he will take you up the four narrow staircases to the attic and show you there the golem, the automaton of Prague. All that you will see will be a mound of inert clay. But the story that goes with this clay is that of a man by the name of Judah Lowy, who was the rabbi in Prague in about 350 years ago, a man who was known as one of the early scientists of the time, around whom wizard tales were told. And presumably at a time when this community was besieged by enemies, Rabbi Lowy constructed the golem and brought the golem to life. And the golem served the community well for some period of time, and then the machinery ran amok, and the golem turned against his creator, and Rabbi Lowy erased the great peril to his life, the letter Aleph, the opening letter of the word Emet, which is on the golem's forehead, and now it no longer reads Emet, truth, but mate, dead. And the golem is, by this act, reduced to its original shape, and the community is spared the consequences of its own creation. Now, what has all of this to do with Egypt and Israel after Iran? It has this to do with the revolution in Iran. That when men make a revolution, they make a golem. There is an enemy. The danger is broadly sensed throughout the community. There is a broadly shared feeling that unless the Shah is toppled from his throne, unless the tyrant is overthrown, things cannot get better. I am physically endangered, or my survival economically is threatened. And so the wizards, the Khomeinis, precipitate the revolution. The golem is brought into being. The golem accomplishes its purpose. The Shah is overthrown, forced into exile. But inevitably, in the course of any revolution, the golem begins to run amok. It begins to turn against those who created it. All of us watched that very moving, powerful scene 2 days ago of literally hundreds of thousands of people in a parade in the streets of Tehran. A sea of humanity shouting in jubilation for the overthrow of the completed overthrow of the peacock throne of the Shah, demanding that the work be completed. And I could not help but think that many of those in that parade would rue the day when they joined in the revolution. The classic example, of course, is the French Revolution. When the golem achieved his work, when the genie got out of the bottle, when the Bourbons were finally overthrown, the constitutional convention was brought into being in Paris, the constitutional government began to move against all of those who were allied in any way with the Louis, the high church, with the powerful feudal nobles. And then as divisions began to appear within that assembly, as it became clear that people were not only rallied to liberty, equality, and fraternity, but to middle-class values or proletarian concerns, concerns of one province or concerns of another, concerns of one part of the society, concerns of another, when the inevitable divergence of concerns, which had somehow been sublimated for a period of time, and the need to overthrow the king, suddenly became loose. Delegation turned against delegation. The left sent the right in the Constitutional Assembly to the guillotine. The terror was mounted. Robespierre came into power, and then Robespierre and the Montaigne themselves went in the tumbrils to the guillotine. Inevitably, once the genie is out of the bottle, once the golem has been created, it takes on a life of its own. And during the course of that lifetime, it turns against many who brought it into being. Many are hurt unexpectedly by the very thing that they have created. In Iran, the revolution was precipitated by a wide divergence of people. A country as diverse as Iran suddenly doesn't coalesce with a single unified national purpose. There is the merchant class that is urban, that needed credit. There's the farming class, which is semi-literate or illiterate, which was fearful of modernization, which was fearful of the consequences of the cost of modernization, particularly in taxation, particularly in the fact that so many of their young people were running away from the farms to take advantage of the life in the city. There was the traditionalists in the religious community, the Shiite mullahs, who wanted to turn the hands of the clock back to regain the great landed estates which had once been then theirs, to regain authority over the social and personal lives of the entire nation, to turn Iran into an Islamic nation. There was the Communist Party, a sizable group in Iran, determined to bring about the communization, the resolution of the class conflicts of the country. And I've only begun to talk of the divisions within the country. There are tribal divisions and provincial divisions and so on. And once everyone has massed for the great moment of release, inevitably group turns against group because their purposes, their agenda, is different one from the other. And because there is no settled power, inevitably those who turn against each other become violent towards each other, and bloodshed continues. Until finally, some years down the path, someone, some small group which is disciplined, which is not afraid to use power, to be tyrannical, assumes power. If we had lived in Paris in 1789 and heard the mob shouting for freedom, for a constitutional assembly, for liberté, qualité, fraternité, we would not have dreamed that a little Corsican colonel by the name of Napoleon Bonaparte would be proconsul, dictator of France, 10 years later. A revolution always breeds a Lenin, a Bonaparte, a Mao, Castro, a figure who is willing at some point to take a destabilized society and impose order. The society has changed, to be sure. But the authoritarianism, the dictatorial elements, remain dominant and powerful. There is no guarantee that Iran, having overthrown a Shah who used the secret police, who had his prisons filled with political prisoners, who had torture, I am told, in those prisons, that the man who's, or group that succeeds him ultimately will be less of a tyrant than the Shah himself had been. And the one thing that can be assured about a revolutionary period is that during this period of convulsion, a society regresses economically and institutionally. It is said that it took Russia 25 years to regain the prosperity, the industrializations, the processes which were in being under the Tsarists to bring Russian economy into modern times before it reached the stage that the economy it had before the Tsars were overthrown. And one of the reasons, of course, that Deng and the other leaders of China have made these overtures to the West is that Mao's permanent revolution, with its cadres of Red Guard moving disruptively through the society, turned the society backwards, reduced its ability to face the basic technological industrialization responsibilities of the social order, so that now they require help from the outside in terms of skills and aid and technology. Iran will not be as well off 5 years from now or whenever the revolution has run its course than it was 6 months ago. We've already begun to see in the newspapers accounts of the economic dislocations in the country, the end of commerce, the end of a number of the major industrialization processes. And even if a new government is achieved, and there will be a series of governments, I am sure, the problem will be that no government will be in long enough to press through, to develop and press through a consistent program to bring Iran from its present confusions to a new set of economic plans which would be useful for a larger segment of the economy, for a larger segment of the population than the Shah's plans were designed to support. None of us are prophets, but those of us who have studied religions, those of us who have studied revolutions, know that in comparative revolutions, there is always a regression of the economic order. There is always systemic challenge to the basic institutions. And finally, those who immediately assume power rarely are those who are able to sustain themselves in power. It's doubtful if Mr. Bakhtiar will be able to remain in power. It's already been indicated in the public press, not only because he represents only one major tribal unit and one major upper middle class economic area of concern, but because he came to power too quickly. And he came to power tainted with at least the grudging consent of the Shah. But there's also no reason to believe that if Khomeini, in fact, comes back to Iran and assumes some kind of power within a government, which is a government of an Islamic republic, satisfactory to him, that he and his republic will remain long in power. And it's not only that he's 78 years of age and is a man who obviously is approaching the point when you relinquish power, but more than that, there are major segments of the Iranian population which will not accept peacefully the imposition of Muslim puritanism, of male chauvinism, of Islamic imperialism, which are all implicit in Khomeini's comments and platform to date. Iran will go through a period which will be a very difficult period for that beleaguered country. And the West, Israel and Egypt, will all suffer because of the destabilization and the consequences of that revolution. For the West, particularly for the United States, the consequences would seem to be that Iran, whoever governs Iran over the near term, Iran will move closer to the bosom of the third world, toward what's called neutralism. There will certainly be a demand that we take down the series of radar and intelligence and surveillance stations which we have established in northern Iran along the 1,600-mile border between Iran and the Soviet Union, part of the forward warning system which the West uses to protect itself from surprise attack. Possibly this will have consequences in terms of a SALT II treaty, because it will make surveillance of Russian activities more difficult. Certainly for the West, the destabilization of Iran will suggest that the ability of the oil-producing states to be a stable source of energy for Europe and Japan and the United States must be questioned. It's not only that Iran itself will now have political aims which will be different than those of the West, and therefore may be deemed likely to impose political as well as cost elements when it is willing to sell oil to the West. One can very easily see how a pan-Islamic, anti-Israel Iranian government might demand that Japan or the European economic market take actions against Israeli goods, remove Israel from membership in the European economic community, where she has preferential trade agreements, vote increasingly against Israel in the United Nations for sanctions and the like. But more than this, with Afghanistan having a pro-Soviet military government, with Iran having a destabilized neutralist government, the border of Saudi Arabia to the north being that of Iraq, the border of Saudi Arabia to the east being that of Iran, possibilities of sabotage, the possibilities of pressure against our major oil supplier increase, and the small feudal Saudi royal family must obviously compromise more and more with the neutralist policies and the pan-Islamic policies of that world. And those are policies which are directed not only against Israel, but increasingly they are directed against all the imperialists, all the capitalist nations. Up till now, the combination of Saudi Arabia and Iran has been able at least to do this within OPEC, to see to it that OPEC decisions are largely cost decisions, pricing decisions. But it's possible to consider that there will come a time when Iran and Libya and Algeria and other countries will be indifferent to the economic consequences of a major oil hike, price hike on the West. In fact, they would be happy to contribute to the destruction of the Western economies, because these are the economies of the predators. These are the economies of the imperialists, the capitalists. And so to jack up the cost, not 5% or 15%, but 50%, is not out of the realm of imagination. And ultimately, if the West wants to maintain its presence levels of indulgence and luxury, as well as out of necessity, the West may have to either take strong military action or pay the price. And it's doubtful if our economies can afford to pay that price. For the United States, there's obviously going to be down the road a major confrontation between President Carter's human rights principles and his concern to deal somehow with whatever government rises to power in Iran. Khomeini, or those like Khomeini, will have much to say in the new Iranian government. And much of what they will say is not only anti-West, but anti-Christian, anti-Baha'i, anti-Parsi, anti-Jew. About 3.5% of the population in Iran is non-Shiite, non-Muslim. And that 3.5% has been a particularly effective element in the bureaucracy, in the technological and governmental bureaucracy of the Shah. From 1502 to the beginning of this century, Iran was ruled by the Safavids, who were Shiite Muslims, to whom all non-believers were barbarians, to all non-believers were pariahs, people whose very touch rendered the object or the person touched unclean. And Khomeini has much of that medieval religious imperialism, which we once associated in the 15th, 16th, 17th century with the Catholic Church in the West. There's only one truth. There is only one way. There is no national conference of Muslims and Christians or Muslims and Jews. They can be tolerated only as long as they do not attempt to rise above the most menial status as they acknowledge the superiority of our way. No Jew, no Christian is to have a major role in government, in industry, in anything that is of consequence. Ultimately, they are to see the light. To give you the sense in which Khomeini speaks, let me read to you from one of his speeches, was published about a week ago. Today, at a time when imperialism and its agents among the traitorous rulers, together with Zionism and atheistic materialism, are joining forces to pervert and mutilate Islam, our responsibility is greater than any time in the past. Before us, we see the Jews making a mockery of the Quran and distorting its text in new editions printed in occupied lands. It is our duty to reveal this treachery, to shout at the top of our voices until people understand the Jews and their foreign masters are plotting against Islam and are preparing the way for the Jews to rule over the entire planet. I greatly fear that by their own special methods, they will indeed realize their desired aims. It's because of our own weakness that we might wake up one morning and find a Jewish ruler dominating our country. God forbid. In Tehran, Christian, Zionist, and Baha'i missionary centers issue their publications in order to mislead people, to alienate them from the teachings and principles of religion. Only one religion, his. Is it not our duty to demolish these centers and to silence these people? The West also faces a crisis among all of its allies of will, of power. Carter will have to decide whether he will respond in terms of human rights to the challenge to the persons of the minorities in Iran when as these emerge. Will he be silent or will he act? Will we have another Lebanon with an abandoned Christian community? Or will there be some way in which American power, Western power, is made evident in the Muslim world so that Muslim imperialism is not allowed to run rampant over the lives of those who do not share their faith? Perhaps the greatest symbol of the last few weeks has been the rather impotent symbol of the American response. We responded to all that was happening in Iran by sending in a squadron of unarmed, fast supersonic fighter planes into Riyadh, into Saudi Arabia. Mao used to speak of the West as paper tigers. And if there was any act which could have symbolized more effectively the paper tiger aspect of our policies in the world is this. And to a world which is the jungle, a world where you get no points for good intentions unless these good intentions are successful, the last years have seen a significant number of opportunities in which America has evidenced the fact that we really do not have the will or the ability, the power, to stand up for those things which American policy says it is committed to. There's not only the defeat in Vietnam, but there's our inability to deal, as we dealt with during the Kennedy administration, with the placing of airborne missiles in Cuba. We made no response except to say somehow they didn't threaten us, but in fact they do threaten us. They wouldn't be there if they didn't. There's the inability to respond in Iran. There's an inability to respond to the presence of Cuban troops as Russian surrogates in sub-Saharan Africa. There's the inability to make any effective response in Lebanon, the attack on the Christian communities there. Again and again and again, as the world looks upon American actions, they see weakness. They see our inability to do much to support whoever we proclaim to be friends. And as a result, all who depend upon American power are weakened. And that's the basic fact of life today for both Israel and Egypt. Both are weaker for what has happened in Iran, in large measure because the United States has shown herself to be weak. the travails and the troubles of Israel that will be generated out of what has happened in Iran have been fairly well documented in the newspapers. There's been a good deal of talk about the loss of an oil supply. Iran provided about 70 to 75% of Israel's oil. But America has had in the second disengagement arrangement in the Sinai, which Secretary Kissinger created in 1976, the United States agreed to be a supplier of last resort, so that Israel will have oil. The oil will come at greater cost, and part of the oil cost is unseen, and that is the political pressures which will now be imposed by Iraq and Iran and the other radical OPEC states, Libya, Algeria, the political cost that the West, Japan, perhaps even the United States will have to pay to buy that oil. But there's another cost. Some years ago, the Israeli government built a pipeline from Eilat to Ashdod. This pipeline was designed to avoid the necessity of the large giant tankers going all the way around the Cape of Africa. And increasingly in the last years, Iranian oil has been shipped in through the Red Sea port of Eilat, pumped through this pipeline to Ashdod, and transshipped to Europe. About 20 million tons of oil a year were transshipped in this way. Israel built a new port in Eilat. Israel built a vast new port in Ashdod in order to be ready for what was hoped would be a major economic benefit from this transshipment of oil, and now this entire operation will be scrapped at great economic cost to the country. About $180 million worth of goods are annually exported from Israel to Iran, largely electronics, drugs, some agricultural produce. Now all of that will be eliminated. Even Bakhtiar, the most moderate of all the leaders we can expect to see in power in Tehran in the next few years, has already announced that there'll be no resumption of oil or trade with Israel. The Solel Boneh, the great government-owned construction cooperative, has about $300 million worth of contracts for various activities in Iran, and these, of course, will be canceled. Iran has been a major center in which Israeli intelligence was able to gather information about the activities of the Arab world, and now much of that will be rendered more difficult. And Israel, of course, may have to pay the cost, find the housing for the 65,000 Iranian Jews when they come out, if they're allowed to come out. And certainly now, if they come out, they will come out largely stripped of whatever wealth they have earned and accumulated in the past years. Israel, too, will suffer from the fact that another one of those countries in which there were the beginnings of a meaningful relationship has been erased. 15 years ago, you recall, Israel hoped essentially to leapfrog over the confrontation states. And by relationships with Ethiopia, relationships with Iran, relationships with Turkey, establish the beginnings of an economic relationship with their own world. Well, the Ethiopian imperial government was overthrown several years ago, and the new communist government threw out the Israeli ambassador and eliminated all Israeli trade. After the 73 war, all the consulates in the sub-Saharan countries were ordered home, and now Iran has been closed. So that only some very minor trade relationships and El Al overflight relationships remain with Turkey among all those countries in that area with which Israel had hoped to enter into basic relationships. Israel stands to lose a good deal by what has happened in Iran. But what people have not recognized is that Egypt perhaps stands to lose even more. And that too, in a way, is sad. It's not a matter of happenstance that when the Shah flew out of Tehran, he flew his plane to Aswan. Why did he go to Egypt? Because the Shah and Mr. Sadat essentially are people who represent the same groups. And they're leaders who face the same problems. Iran and Egypt were both emerging states. They were the two states with the greatest number of technically trained people in the Middle East. They were the two states of the Middle East in which the religious leaders had been cut away from power, in which the battle of church and state had essentially been won by the state. But they were both states in which the church leaders, the mosque leaders, had not peacefully accepted this decision. We've now seen the power of the mullahs in Iran. Well, there's a Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood, which was pushed out of power largely during the Nasser Rebellion, the years of the Nasser Revolt, has remained a major power, particularly in the countryside, particularly among the less literate, the poorer elements of the community. I don't know if you noticed it, but about a year ago, the Egyptian parliament passed a law which declared it to be a capital crime for a non-Muslim community, that is largely a Christian community, to convert a Muslim to Christianity. Now, this law was passed under terrific pressure from the Muslim majority in Egypt. It was never put into operation because the Coptic Christian minority was sufficiently strong to prevent its actually going to practice, because in the villages it's common for a bride raised in one farmer's home who happens to be Muslim to marry into a Christian farmer's home and to take on the tradition of the Christian farmer. To have passed this law and made it effective would have been to create chaos in some of the smaller villages. But the pressure was there, and the Muslim Brotherhood is there. And Sadat's power, which rests largely on the urban middle class, technologically skillful, is weakened by the evidence that is apparent to anyone in Dar al-Islam, in the Islamic world, as to the power of religion. Sadat also faces the increasing division which is sensed in Iran between the rich and the poor. As the poor nations begin to emerge inevitably, those who know gain more, and they gain more at a geometric rate as opposed to the poor, the illiterate or the semi-literate, who make small steps into the new prosperity. And the divisions between the rich and the poor become more apparent, particularly as movies and television moves into the out-of-the-way villages and people can see the luxuries and compare them to the simplicities, the poverty in which they live. Inevitably, this clashes, creates social tension. Just a year ago, there were bread riots in Cairo. The middle class faces, as it did in Iran, a credit crunch. Many of the problems are similar. And there's a new sense down there among the masses that we can have our way. And then too, finally, both Iran and Egypt were trying to go their own way in the Arab world. Both are nations which are not Arab. They are Islamic, but not Arab. Iran means Aryan. They are proud of their northern ancestry. Egypt has always believed itself to be a separate cultural community, a separate biological stock, Egyptian to the core. They're Islamic, but racially not Arab. And increasingly, these two countries were trying to go their own way, to steer their course politically in ways that were advantageous to them rather than conforming to the whole thrust of a pan-Islamic world, with the elimination of Israel, the elimination of imperialism, and so on being its major objectives. They felt they could deal with the West. They felt they could come to some kind of modus vivendi with Israel. But Iran now is in a different camp, and Sadat is increasingly isolated. And Sadat has gambled that American prosperity and the American military and American technology will be able to shore his power up sufficiently so that he, in a sense, can go it alone. But today, after the fall of Iran, he must increasingly go it alone. And he's increasingly threatened, both from without and from within. It's one thing when the enemy was simply the Baghdad coordination of Iraq and Iran, and when Iraq was still concerned as to its southern border with Iran. But now Iran and Iraq will have similar political policies. The Iraqi army can move towards Syria and join with Syria in a northern front against Israel, a powerful northern front against Israel. The Saudis are increasingly threatened. They will probably have to take an increasingly militant posture. Egypt receives millions and tens of millions of dollars of both trade and aid from the Saudis every year. If that aid is cut off and that trade is eliminated under pressure, how long can Mr. Sadat remain in power? I don't know if some of you saw an article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal this week, written by Irving Kristol. Irving Kristol said essentially, it was a very pessimistic article, he said essentially that if a Islamic Republic is established in Iran, the truth of the matter is that American power has virtually been eliminated from the Middle East, and that the Camp David Accords are a dead letter. And if you follow the logic which I have been suggesting up till now, you can see how Mr. Kristol, who is a very perceptive observer, came to this conclusion. But of course, there's another possibility. And the other possibility is that if the United States displays some spine and is willing to adjust its policies to a new reality, there may just be a chance that the pressures for an Israeli-Egyptian peace agreement have been increased to the point where such an agreement will be effected, provided both countries can feel secure that the United States will not only provide them with the military support they need and the economic support they need, but that the United States will not force either of them to relate these accords to what's called a comprehensive peace, the larger concerns to the north of Israel. Because very clearly, Syria, Iraq, Iran are in no mood to accommodate Israel. They're flushed with victory. They're flushed with triumph. They sense their power. Why accommodate? And clearly, Jordan is too weak to do anything but go along as best she can with her northern masters. There's no chance now for a meaningful, comprehensive peace to be worked out in the Middle East. But as long as the American government continues to pressure Egypt and Israel to work in that direction, so long does she effectively place their future in the hands of the enraged, all-triumphant North, the poorer Arabs, the more radical Arabs. And so long does she cancel out any opportunity for Egypt and Israel to arrange a new power center, which may ultimately be able to be established itself and have some kind of economic viability and give America a stable presence among allies in the Eastern Mediterranean. It's a long shot. The Camp David Accords, because of events in Iran, are clearly further away today than they were a month ago. The Middle East is clearly in an imperialist mood. It's almost as if the Crusades of the Middle Ages were now being canceled and Islam was again sensing its power to dominate the world. It will not dominate the world. There are limits to all power. Iran is going to implode rather than to be a major source of concern to the rest of the world, except economically. The Arabs are not as advanced as they would like to think themselves to be. There are many unresolved battles within the Arab world which will be fought out in the years that lie ahead. But for that kind of development which has always been associated with the West, technological development within some kind of relatively free social order, what has happened in Iran is a setback. And for the countries who are committed to that kind of development to coalesce together, Iran also creates new problems. Egypt and Israel after Iran are weaker and not stronger. Mr. Sadat's very ability to remain in power is threatened. Israel's ability to find a modus vivendi with its neighbors is circumscribed and limited. What the future will be, no one knows. But it's a new ballgame, with new players, new pressures. And whatever policies our government must adopt, I pray, will reflect some recognition of the changed circumstances, the limitation of possibilities which now exists. There's an old saying among those who study revolution: it's easy to make a revolution, but only the lucky survive their own creation. Amen.